Hey, welcome to the Charlie Paparelli Show. I'm Charlie Paparelli. Today, we're going to be talking about leading your company in an economic contraction, a VC's perspective. To be sure not to miss an episode, please subscribe at paparelli.com. All you have to do is submit your email address, and you'll be notified of the shows and my blogs. This show is all about entrepreneurs helping entrepreneurs, and today we have a VC who was formerly in entrepreneurship, is now going to be helping us on his perspective. My guest today is Alan Tatel. He is the managing partner of Nora Mosley. So welcome, Alan. That's great. Alan is the managing partner, as I said, of what is the most established, the longest going VC firm in the Atlanta area called Nora Mosley Partners. Alan became a VC after leaving Mindspring, one of the hottest, fastest growth startups that went public back in the late 90s. And he was, I think, the chief marketing officer is the way he was then. And what was a key part of the leadership team at the time. And he left there and moved into the venture capital role. So he's been in VCs, in the VC business for over 20 years. Alan, as I look at Alan, is a seasoned VC. He's been around the block. He's been through expansions. He's been through contractions multiple times here. I'm also blessed to call Alan a friend. He is somebody who has invested in the community, you know, without ever holding back. Whenever you ask Alan to do a favor for you in the community, he's the first person that's going to jump in and do it. And he's well respected not only by me, but everybody that knows him. So he is he's a gift to our community. And Alan, thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie. And back, not to make this a love fest, but back at you. I am very proud to call you a friend. And we need to get a lunch on the calendar. That's my cost.
We actually have a lunch on the calendar for next Wednesday.
Oh, we do. Yeah, that's right.
So, I thought it was funny because we're going to do this interview and then we're going to do this lunch, which I think is kind of unique.
All right. Hopefully we'll find other things to talk about at lunch.
Well, just to get sort of do a little bit of a level set, maybe you could just talk, do a brief overview of maybe Nora Mosley Partners.
Sure.
And then we'll get into my questions.
Okay, great. So, Nora Mosley, as Charlie said, was founded in 1983. We are one of the largest and most successful venture capital firms, certainly in the Southeast United States. I call ourselves a 20-year overnight success story. You know, it took us a little while to find our footing to change, and we evolved our strategy starting in about 2006. To be what we call an early growth stage investor, where we invest in companies with $1 to $5 million in recurring revenue. We've started to focus much more deeply on certain sectors in the business software market, as well as in healthcare services and healthcare IT. As Charlie said, I have been here 24 years. I co-manage this firm with my partner, Alan Mosley. And, just thrilled to, I love this job and thrilled to keep doing it.
All right. Well, you do it well. That's for sure.
Thank you.
I'm sure you provided some great returns for it. What fund are you on, by the way?
We're raising fund 9 right now.
Fund number. Oh, you're raising again. I just talked to you before.
Yeah.
You're raising.
Yeah. Yeah. Something to talk about over lunch.
Yeah. How big was this last fund?
The last fund was 8,
which is when
fund 8
when
was $180 million.
Okay.
And we still have a couple of investments we want to do out of that fund. And then we're targeting $250 million for our next fund.
I love it. And we're going to be getting into that. I'm going to be talking a little bit, not only about the environment and some of the advice that you're giving to entrepreneurs, but also, you know, the challenges that you have, you know, as you sort of look forward in a contraction like this, you know, as VCs, because I think it's important for entrepreneurs to understand if they're looking to raise money, you know, what challenges are the people from whom they're raising money, right, also have, you know. Mm-hmm. We can't be self-centered here. So
right.
I wanted to start with, overall, what I'd like to do is this sort of comparison from where we just left to where we're just now going, okay, economically, if you will. All right. So maybe you can describe the economic conditions that we're sort of exiting from now. What was it like, you know, over the last 2 to 3 years here? You know, what was the environment like?
Yeah, so the last 2 or 3 years, you know, and Charlie and I were talking before we started that the last time I was on his show was when COVID started. And at the beginning of COVID, there was a ton of uncertainty, you know, lots of people just trying to figure out how to batten down the hatches. And it turned out COVID, I won't say it was a non-event, but from a venture capital perspective, it was a positive event in that there was lots of technology startups that accelerated, you know, the classic one, of course, being someone like Zoom or some of the e-commerce companies all of a sudden were taking a larger share because people couldn't get out of the house. And so there were a lot of good stories. And then the last couple of years have been unprecedented investment levels. And with unprecedented investment levels comes incredible increases in valuations, particularly in the late stage funding. I mean, I don't know if everyone's read about Tiger Global and the 56% reduction in their fund valuation they took in the first quarter, just extraordinary.
Well, you mentioned unprecedented, would you say investment levels?
Yes.
Yeah, so why don't you explain that just a little bit?
Yeah, so I don't have the figures in front of me, but last year, the fourth quarter of last year was, let's just say, was $70 billion in investment. It might have even been higher.
Investment in what?
In private equity firm, you know, in venture-backed companies.
Venture-backed companies. Okay, yeah. So I just want to make sure we're not including private equity because that's a whole nother level there.
Yeah, no, this is all about venture.
And then
let's just say, and again, this is, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but 3 or 4 years ago, $70 billion would have been the whole year.
So you can
I don't think people appreciated the velocity of how things were happening, you know. You know, somebody, you know, one of these big firms whose objective was to create a global private index fund. You know, I'm talking about the Tigers, the Insight Globals, the Coatus of the world, would potentially deliver a term sheet very light in terms of stipulations at a valuation that would be maybe 4 to 5x what I would even ponder considering for a late stage exit.
You know, well, they're not unintelligent people. I mean, why was their investment thesis so different than yours? How were they hoping to make money? What are they banking on that you said this is too much risk for me at this value?
Yeah, they're banking on two things, and I will say that experience helps in this. And you know, those guys are super successful. I'm not saying they're not experienced, but their thesis was, okay, I'm going to put $100 million at $1 billion valuation of this company, even though it's $5 million in revenue. Worst thing that can happen is I get my $100 million back. That's fake news, just to start off with, okay?
You know, bad first assumption?
Bad first assumption. You know, that it's just like falling off a log to get, you know, $100 million back, okay? And then they said, we're making an index fund, so we are going to, you know, if we throw enough companies in here, we're going to de-risk the portfolio because of how large it is, you know, similar to why you buy an index fund.
Okay.
You know, so there was those two objectives, which I think are both fundamentally flawed.
So now what you said is that with this contraction, we see these things. You mentioned something about Tiger.
Tiger Global.
Tiger Global. It dropped by 56%.
Last quarter.
Okay, so is that where you said it proved both their assumptions wrong?
Yes, it did. You know, and for me, Charlie, it was like I don't want to sound awful, but I've been shouting at the rain for a long time.
Oh, have you? Okay.
About crypto and about you know, some of the fintech valuations in particular. You know, and that type of market dynamic was not helpful to, you know, us who are tried and true, early growth investments, underwrite to a $300 million exit, you know, don't want to overcapitalize companies. And it made a nice opportunity for us because all of a sudden all the funds got so large that we were like one of the only a handful of companies that could write a $10 million check. Everybody else needed to write 20 or 30 because of their fund size.
So you wound up, because they sort of abdicated that space, you wound up with a unique proposition.
Yeah.
Didn't somebody come up from the bottom and try to fill that, though? I mean, wasn't there a lot of other competition in that space?
No, because we're still, if you're north of $5 million in revenue, let's just say, that's a, then you start to see some of the growth equity players. But, you know, Summit, we're very close to them. We've done three or four deals with them. And, you know, they really like a business to be $10 million in revenue, and $10 million check is just not worth it to them.
I got it.
Because their funds, I think, I don't know what their growth fund is, probably $750 million. You can't have 75 portfolios.
No, that's the problem with it. Yeah. But this, it really has been an interesting economic condition that we've been through, and market conditions too. You know, I look at my, my son, who's now just turned 29 in March. You know, he went to work. He's making good money. He's part of a public tech company, right? Everything just was going up. You know, he didn't even, you know, it was those point where he didn't know a down market. Whereas when I came out of college, I came out of college in a down market.
Right.
Right. I didn't trust there would ever be an up market, you know.
And you came out in an era which none of us have lived through. You came out in an inflationary.
Yeah, we did. That was crazy.
I mean, you know, you and Warren Buffett, I mean, not that you're Warren Buffett's age, but literally everybody's in our business has never invested in an inflationary environment.
Right.
You know, and most people haven't invested during a bear market either. You know, even more, you know, haven't. So.
And that's what we're going to talk about too. But so here we have, you know, we're coming out of an environment, you know, how would you describe the impact this environment had on the entrepreneurial sort of startup ecosystem, if you will?
Well, on the positive side, money came into all stages of venture capital firms. Look at Atlanta. You know, Charlie, how many seed funds have started here? Four?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and they're institutional. We've never had that. So, you know, the influx of capital chasing the returns has been one big positive thing. As far as the rest of it, there was, you know, all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but because of what I just described to you in terms of the availability of money, a company that was doing $5 million in revenue thought, well, I'll tell you one in town and not naming names, a company of $7 million in revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Hadn't raised outside capital, great people. They wanted 200 because they'd seen others get it.
$7 million in revenue. Okay.
200, and they got it. Yeah. You know, so there were a number of companies in Atlanta even that are very good companies that, you know, that some of these big players came into at really big valuations. And so you hope they raise enough money to earn into that valuation.
Because if they don't earn into that valuation, what happens? And I need more money. What happens?
It's going to be an ugly down round if you can get it.
If you can get it.
Yeah.
So why isn't that VCs, you know, even though the company might be still a good company and viable, it certainly didn't hit its growth projections. So, and the market's valuations came down and the growth projections, they didn't hit those. So now it's a double hit. So they got this ratcheted down valuation of, let's say they're at $10 million in revenue. And now people are saying it's worth $70
million.
Yeah. Right?
Right.
Which is reasonable.
Yeah.
So now what happens? Now I'm $130 million valuation-wise underwater. What happens to the entrepreneur?
Yeah, so they get it from two or three sides. First, they get it that most of the securities that we've been talking about, these later stage securities, have a weighted average anti-dilution clause, meaning that their basis gets reprice based on the previous rounds. And so all of a sudden their ownership, would, which was 15, might go to 25 because they got, you know, because they are now at the same price at, or not at a blended average of the same price of the previous round.
And you got, they don't average down. They actually get that new price.
They get that new price, but you know, and so if a full ratchet would be, they get everything repriced at the new price.
Okay.
A weighted average says you get a certain percentage at the new price and a certain percentage at the price you pay.
I got it.
So,
okay.
You know, but nonetheless, that's more, you know, that's just stock that's issued, right, to the existing investors. And you got the new round, you know, and by the way, your stock options are really screwed up because your stock option values were based on this really large round that came in at $200 million. So all of a sudden you have to reprice your stock options, which is, you know, just a, and if the board doesn't want to do that, then people are going to leave the company. You know, I mean, so yeah, it's, you know, and
the other side of it is, why on a down round like that, you know, if you're the VC that happened to come in and in fact, overpriced it. Okay.
Yeah.
You're at a decision point saying, do I leave my money behind and move on? Okay. Or do I fund this company further?
Right.
So at this down round, and then I'm looking for partners again, probably, right? You know?
Yeah. No, you raise a great point.
That whole process, how does that process work? You know, how do you make a decision? Am I in or out?
Well, you know, at the stage when you're thinking about a down round, you're probably, you're moving out of, hey, this is going to be a 5 to 7X, and back to the original thesis, I want to get my capital back.
Okay.
So you might, so you're exploring two options. Is, could I put the company up for sale and get my capital back? And all of a sudden, you know, the owners of the business are, you know, basically their common is wiped out, and, you know, they'll get something, you know, for, because they have to sign the documents, but it's going to be incredibly disappointing.
Right.
You know, and then if they say, well, we can't get our money back, but it's still a good business, then they could go to the down round. But the reason why it's so hard to do a down round for someone like us is that if the company recovers, like you hope it will, then some of the people who invested at a higher price might sue you, saying that you got too good a deal, and, you know, you had, you know, too much information, and it's just, it can be really messy.
So that's why, know? That's why new money doesn't want to go into down rounds. I thought it was because they just never wanted to be the bad guys, and there's other opportunities that are a lot cleaner.
It's that too. It's super messy, but I can't tell you that there's so many times when, you know, a company turns around and becomes successful, and all of a sudden the shareholders that were, you know, have stock at an incredibly high price will come after you. And by the way, or, you know, if you go to sell the business, you need at least 95% shareholder approval to sell most businesses. You've been through this.
Hmm.
You know, and so these guys who might have 5% at a super high price would be like, I'm not approving this deal. I'm not getting anything out of it. And all of a sudden the deal's at risk. You got to really, you know, so basically the cap table's got to be pretty clean where there's like only one or two shareholders, in my opinion, for a down round to work. And then you get that all, and that they're institutions for the most part, you know, because we're all playing the long game here, right? You know, and so we don't want to do something like that. But
this goes back to when we're in an expansive environment like this, then those, we believe as entrepreneurs, we believe we can just get higher and higher valuations, which means less and less dilution for me, which is what I'm really after. Not thinking about that there ever, you know, if we're in an expansion for a long enough time, never thinking that there would ever be a contraction of valuations.
Right. You're right. Right. You know, I mean, and we, you know, Charlie, we tell that to our entrepreneurs all the time, you know, that you, you may be able to get like a super high valuation, but you've got to earn into that. And a lot of things can happen, like, a down market and inflation that, you know, would give you a lot of pause because you're going to end up in a messy down round, which is going to hurt you if you're lucky.
Yeah. It was funny. I was talking to on one of something like this. I happened to get into one of these unicorns with a that I never thought was. I didn't even want to make this investment. It wound up. It turns into a unicorn, and I was talking to Blake, and I said, they just got this round financed for so much money. You know, these billion plus dollars. I said, what should I do with what I have? He said, I think you should sell half of what you have. And I said, well,
oh, absolutely.
I said, why? And he says, because you'll make money on the half and whatever happens after that. He says, the problem with unicorns is at some point they actually have to become real companies and they have to credibly substantiate that valuation that they have, you know?
Yeah. And there's something like 32 dragons. You know what a dragon is? A $10 billion valuation.
What is it?
A $10 billion
valuation. Oh, okay. That's a dragon. Okay.
That's a dragon. Can you imagine? You're absolutely, Blake is a smart man, you know.
Plus,
the bigger the rounds, you know this, you lose influence. Blake loses influence because the new guy's driving the show, so you're just along for the ride.
No, that's where you are at the time, yeah. And we're just assuming the last guy that came in, like you said, that guy that priced the round at $200 million. You're sitting there with as a early investor saying, oh, my God, I multiply my share times 200 million. I'm making a lot of money on this deal. And so I feel, I'm along for the ride. What a great ride. He's always going to put money into this thing. But the fact is, and the ratchet down, like you said, he won't,
Well, and what's made it even more complicated is a lot of these rounds, because of how much capital they want to put to work, are buying founder shares. I won't name names. A company I know raised it was a $4 million revenue company. A big growth equity firm came in and gave them $250 as a valuation, $75 million. And then they put $7.5 million in the founder's pocket, which good for the founder. But, the employees know that, it's just, there's a lot of acrimony that can happen there. And I'm fully supportive. I love giving some shareholder liquidity even in our rounds, not a ton, but I don't want people to suffer, to suffer or be living in, some sort of financial kitchen restraint. But, I want them to be able to redo their kitchen, get their kids into whatever school they want to go into. You know what I mean? It's just buy an upscale Honda, not $7.5 million.
Yeah, not sitting here saying, I'm really worth $120 million, even though I'm driving this 15-year-old Honda, like you said, give the guy a little bit of a break. He did create.
Exactly.
He does deserve something. Yeah, that's good. So how long does it take for entrepreneurs? You've been through this once before, this expansion and then contraction. So how long does it take for entrepreneurs to readjust to this upcoming contraction? What we're seeing, I see a couple of things happening. I mean, like we just saw, Park Mobile that just did a big layoff?
Well, yeah, and OneTrust. Laid off.
And OneTrust. I just read about
that. Huge layoff.
So they're 1,000 people. Those are entrepreneurs that they acted very quickly, right? They said, we can see we got high valuations and we need to hold on to our money, right?
And
I always say the quickest way for an entrepreneur to spend money is to hire people.
Right.
There's no variable cost associated with that. Every 2 weeks, expect a check.
It's recurring expenses, right? It's not just one time.
Right. So there are some that have acted very quickly, but how long does it take for people to kind of believe, no, we're not going to continue to grow? Because I see that with entrepreneurs I'm invested in. They're convinced. Every entrepreneur believes – I think every entrepreneur I've ever been involved with believes that their business is recession-proof.
Yeah, that they're in a microeconomic sector that's not going to be affected.
Correct.
Even though the macroeconomic sector is, you know, they think, oh, in our sector, things are different.
They're different. Yeah. It's not going to hit them.
No. I mean, even, you know, one that's been relatively well protected is cybersecurity right now. But I was just reading an article in the Dow Jones this morning where it said, yeah, they're doing okay, but now all their buyers want to make sure they have enough capital on the balance sheet to stay in business, you know, because that's a major, you know, so all of a sudden you might have thought you had enough capital, but if, you know, you're going to sell a Fortune 500, hey, I'm going to manage a good part of your security system, maybe having $20 million on the balance sheet isn't going to do it anymore. So, you know, all of a sudden they might have some needs.
You mean you don't have enough balance sheet strength to convince them that you can do this?
Yes.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. Everyone, the stages that it goes through right now, we're in, you know, most people, I mean, at least most of the firms I've been around, including a lot of ours, you know, did make some pretty serious cuts, you know, after Q1.
Your portfolio companies did that? Was there a lot of pressure that you had to put on them, or did you have entrepreneurs that were experienced enough? That's the issue.
Yeah.
Doing your first layoff.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of convincing for somebody to do the first layoff. I mean, for the person that did their first layoff, the second one's not so bad. It's like, yeah, that was like, I did it too late. It cost me too much. I'm doing this one sooner.
Yeah. Right.
So with your portfolio companies, they moved more quickly. How did that work out?
Yeah. Well, we pushed that.
Oh, you did?
You know, our thesis is you don't want to have to raise money within the next 12 months.
Okay.
You really don't. You know, I'm not sure how long this, you know, the headwinds are going to happen, but, you know, if we don't get a hold of inflation and oil doesn't settle down, you know, we could be in for, you know, a couple of years of this. You know, the good side is that the banks are in much better shape and, you know, it's not as, you know, there isn't as many structural issues associated with this downturn. But yeah, you know, if you have to raise money soon, that's bad. So most people, you know, the deal flow is really dried up, right? Because people are freezing, you know, because both investors aren't sure what to pay right now because it's a falling knife. And because, you know, the entrepreneurs really don't want to know what their company's worth, right?
Got it.
You know? Yeah. So they're just holding.
It's funny. You said the deal flow is really drying up. And the first thing you talked about was investors, you know, saying, I'm not sure what to pay. But that has nothing to do with the deal flow. The deal flow is the second piece, right? I mean, is
the
it
deal flow is
drying up? Are people that were looking for money now saying, I'm not going to look for money? They are.
Yeah, it's like the housing market. I don't know if you've been noticing that too, but, you know, people are just taking their house off the market, you know, so they were, you know, including our companies. Some of them had big plans to try to raise a $30 to $50 million growth round in Q3. No more. No more. You know, let's just, you know, lower our growth rate, preserve our cash, put our head down, grow, but, you know, don't grow as much as we, you know, don't grow at all costs. Burn rate is so much more important than growth in some ways right now.
With this downdraft that's happened in the markets, okay?
Yeah.
What percentage would you say of your portfolio companies, you know, all of a sudden find themselves below the valuation of their last round?
Well, you know, it's a great question, Charlie, because we always want to provide the most accurate valuation that we can on our companies, you know.
You mean to your LPs?
To our LPs.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, so if our LP valuation was based, if the company's large enough, you base it partially, at least in some large part, on public comps and taking a discount against the public comps. If the public comps are down 30 or 40%, and you don't do anything, you're not being truthful, right? So, you know, first you have the reductions of the public comps and the valuation. And, you know, then we share that with our CEOs, you know, but
that's just a quick question. I mean, if public comps come down 30-40%, how does that correlate to private valuations? Does that mean private valuations will fall comparably, or will they fall even more?
They will fall even more.
So if I'm down 30% in the market, I could be down 50% on private valuation.
Because of scale and illiquidity, you know. So there's some discount, but it might even be larger because of because of the downdraft that you're seeing. So, you know, so but then there's a lot of other companies that are just 2 to 5 million in revenue, and it might be worth $40 million, at least, you know, $30, $40 million, and have $10 million of cash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to say what that company, the company's not worth, you know, what you pay, but it's hard, you know, you could say that it is, but, you know, there's no outside data point. You know, you're not going to pay to have a professional valuation done, and there's no outside data point that you can get that can corroborate it one way or the other. So that's a little bit why private company valuations come down slower than public company valuations.
Okay.
You know, is just because there are a lot of things where it's.
Well, the key that you said too is in the Tiger Global situation, their valuations actually far exceeded public valuations.
Absolutely.
Right. So,
no, absolutely.
And what you did as a co-managing partner here at Norm Mosley is to say, we have to stick to what we believe is the proper valuation on a business. And we have to walk from some of these very attractive deals because we just can't get there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was hard, man. I mean, yeah, there are times when you just felt like, what have I done? You know, did I just not fund, you know, they're seeing this incredible opportunity and we're just seeing something that's worth $40 or $50 million, you know, and, you know, are they right? For a while, it's like, are they right? And we're wrong in how we look at things, but.
It's so hard too. You know, that's the other thing as an investor, I can tell you, this reminds me back in the late 2000, in the late 90s. Okay. The whole .com thing. Mm-hmm. I said that I remember when we were valuing companies. You know, what was it? Netscape was first $1 billion company with zero revenue.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was unbelievable to me. You know?
I remember.
Yeah.
They got public.
They did.
That was a watershed.
It was a watershed. The other thing that happened, I remember sitting in a technology executive roundtable and David Ellis was there. And I told David, I said, when did we start talking multiples of revenue with regard to valuation versus multiples of earnings?
Of EBITDA.
It just changed.
It did.
It changed. That was all at that time. Now that's how we talk, right? I mean, that's when it started. And so I look at this and I say, I don't know, where is this? I forgot what my question was going to be, in fact, but it was, where is this going?
Yeah.
You know?
I still think we're in multiples of revenue, but I think, you know, you have to show a clear path to profitability, you know, that you can, that the unit economics work and that you can, you know, and that you can turn cash flow positive at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with some of these companies, they would burn $3 million a month and they'll think about cash flow positive like when they're $125 million.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't work.
The Facebook model, right? I mean, mm-hmm. when I get to 1 billion users, we're going to make $1 billion a year. But until then, we're going to lose $1 billion a year, right?
Right. Yeah, that's a great
idea. So just keep funding us until we get this base in place. And then, my God, it'll just take off. And it did. Okay.
Yeah, but, and they were right.
They were right. Yeah.
Even then, God, do you remember when they went out? $100 billion valuation?
Yep.
That wasn't that long ago. I thought that was crazy.
And you know? Do you remember that it all of a sudden, I think they went out at about $36 a share, and within a couple of weeks, they were at 20.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Right. Right.
Then they far exceeded that, obviously,
right.
You know, as they grew their business and did very, very well for investors.
Yeah, but a starting point of $100 billion was, we're just too old school, Charlie. You know, it's just how much money can you really make?
I know what my point was going to be when I mentioned this, the late 90s, is this is where I just understand. Maybe you can help me with this as an investor, is when everybody around you is saying, yeah, it's normal. You can have $1 billion valuation and no revenue. I mean, it's just normal. I mean, that's the way it is, you know? And I'm saying, like, what, doesn't cash matter anymore? Cash flow? Doesn't anybody care about profitability? Doesn't? And it was no, 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 no. And at the very end stages, I became a believer in this great lie and wound up losing, you know, a couple of $100,000, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the same thing now, you know, it's as an investor, you sit there and you see Tiger Global's doing what they're doing and all this, you're losing deals. Your LPs are expecting you to move money. That's why they gave it to you. Right. So you got that pressure, that back pressure. You know, how do you stay away from changing what you fundamentally believe is true?
Yeah.
You know, how do you stay to, how do you become, stay as the Charlie Munger?
Right.
When you see crypto prices sort of exploding, right?
he called crypto rat poison squared. I love that. So, yeah. You know, so,
how do you keep your discipline? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because you must have lost those three deals in a row that you were.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, yeah. It was I couldn't get money in.
There was a lot of navel gazing, you know, over the last several years associated with that. But I mean, I will tell you, the rounds that we play in, this, you know, the A's and the B's, they have increased on a multiple maybe 3 to 4 times in the last 4 years. So what you once paid
increased in multiple.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So or in yeah. So in a deal that you would have paid $5 million for 4 years ago, you're going to pay 15 to 20, which is not you know anything to you know, it's concerning, but the late stage deals, the ones that Tiger have, they've had an 11x increase in the last 4 years.
Oh, I see.
In the late stage valuations. So even though we're starting, Charlie, at, you know, 30 or 40, and this is what we had to do. We had to bend. Okay. We bent our valuations up, but we did not, we did not chase the $7 million, $200 million financing.
Yeah, but still your risk is instead of doing trying to hit an IRR of say 18 to 20% or greater, okay, your risk could be that all of a sudden you're at 8.
Right.
You know, because those valuations never really came back.
Right.
You know, to justify what you paid for it even.
Yeah, I still feel like we're still in this sub $100 or $100 million valuation world. I still think it's, you know, the math still works for the most part, you know, and if we end up with a flat round, that's not the end of the world for the entrepreneur or for us, you know?
So that's where you are. You're in the, that's a great way to look at it. So as a VC, I'm looking to invest under $100 million valuation.
Post money.
I'm not competing with the people that are investing in $1 billion companies or, you know, $1 billion valuation type round.
Yeah. I don't want to own 1% of a $1 billion company.
That makes a lot of sense. So what advice? So if you've got a fast growth company, you put money in and your round is how much, you know, so a series A that you've done.
$15 million.
Yeah. And that was all going to go to growth.
Yes. So, well, and except for maybe the Honda in the kitchen.
Yeah, I get that. Okay.
Yeah. So you're gonna, like $1 million to the entrepreneur. Let's
fine.
Just,
yeah, so yeah. 14 million to growth. And so the strategy becomes, you know, use that money to maintain your momentum, your growth momentum. This situation hits, this environment that we're faced with now. First, describe the environment we're faced with. And then secondly, what advice are you giving to these entrepreneurs? You know, that's different from what you gave them when you wrote the check.
Yeah. Well, you know, a great deal for us is it goes from 1 to 4. So it's growing incredibly fast year over year. And then, you know, theoretically, you'd like the 4 to be 8 the year you invest.
You lost me there. Tell me that.
Okay. So 1 million recurring revenue when we have identified it.
Okay.
It grows to $4 million in recurring revenue. We invest
in a year.
Okay, in a year.
Whoa,
really fast growth.
Okay,
you know, but it's a small base, right, Charlie? I mean, you know, so you're, you know, from 500,000 to 2 million. You know, you land two or three customers, you're in great shape. Mm-hmm. You know, not easy, but it's certainly possible. Once we invest in at that $4 million rate, you know, normally we look for 100% growth the next year. So we want to go from 4 to 8.
Okay.
Okay. But, you know, if it took, let's just say it took $6 million, 500,000, you know, $6 million in capital investment to get from 4 to 8, $500,000 burn a month. That's not acceptable anymore. So you go back to the math and you say, how fast can we grow if we're only burning $350 a month so that we have, you know, so that the cash goes longer. So you kind of solve backwards to that, which is very different than what, you know, how you invested.
Well, when you invested and you were going to burn it $500,000, oh, you were burning it $500,000 a month to double it?
Yes, exactly.
How long was that round supposed to, when was it anticipated you would do the next fundraising?
18 months.
Okay. So you're doing the same thing now and saying, we're going to raise in 18 months? Or have you then said, no, I'm tacking on another 12?
We basically, yeah, we're saying add time. You may not need it, but add time.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, so yes.
That's, yeah. That's so the de-risking piece. So I'll take a lower valuation and lower growth
in
business.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, for investors in our part of the world, loss ratios matter a ton. We don't have that many 45Xers that, you know, make up for all the little guys going, you know, that mm-hmm. underperform. So losses really mean a big deal in our market. You know, not to castigate the entrepreneur at all. It's just our big wins are 10X. So you can't have as many losses to really create a venture style return like you described. So, yeah, so we take all this stuff incredibly seriously, you know, and a lot of it is right now it's about, okay, we want to have optionality. So we don't want to be in a place where we have to raise money 12 months from now. You know, we want to be able to say we could if we wanted to, but we have enough money to keep going.
Right. So basically, so the advice that you would give, another way to say this, is to say, if you were one of those companies that was raising money from professional money, then what you need to do is take whenever you thought you were going to raise again and extend that at least 12 months.
Yes.
That's a good way to kind of look at it. Then you can kind of back into what burn you can sustain.
Right. And don't bring a plan that shows you burning a million plus a month. You know, don't do it.
Well, the problem with that, too, is that you get to you're burning a million plus a month and then you're sitting there and you're now on your same schedule, which is I have to raise money.
Yeah.
You know, by December of 2022. Yeah. Right. And you sit there and you say, good luck.
Right. Right. You know,
that's going to be hard, considering also your life valuation.
Right. Right. And then you have the conversation, cut your burn, or we'll find somebody who will,
Well, then the other piece of this, too, I wonder what you're saying to companies or what you're seeing maybe some of your companies doing. You know, what specific tactics are they putting in place now to save customers, reduce churn, you know, in their base and all that? Because that's because everybody's getting hit, like you said, you know, even corporations that they're selling to, the Fortune 500 are getting hit and saying they're ratcheting down, right, to protect their earnings. So they're looking at everything closely. I mean, just recently, I remember I just recently, and I'm talking, I was just on a trip with Kathy. We were over in the UK and it hit me. And I said, I read some article on subscriptions that people have. And I started saying, I'm going to put a spreadsheet together on all my subscriptions.
No.
I mean, I said, I'll probably spend a couple of $1,000s a year on subscriptions.
You and me both. And how often are we watching AMC Plus? You know, like never.
Name it, right. Name it. Okay. You know, they said, I remember there was one for me just recently is Curiosity, you know, which is one of these, right? And it said it used to cost like $10 a year. And they gave me a deal. They said, will you do it for $2 a year? And I'm like, that's $2. You know? But what I did is I listed all of these things in a spreadsheet and it came out to more than 2x. What I expected that I'm paying every year for these stupid little subscriptions, most of which I use maybe once in a blue moon, right?
Right.
So I'm wondering, you know, corporations have got to be doing the same thing on recurring revenue, right?
Yes.
You know, I've made a list. They're making a list in their division saying, are we really using this stuff? And show me how we're getting value from it. So how do you, as from the entrepreneur standpoint, you know, how do I participate in that? And, you know, my son, one last question, one other thing. My son is selling that. He's trying to hold on to these customers for a public company. And he's saying he is having this year, last year, he ran off with his hitting quota. Yeah. This year, he's saying, oh, my God, will I hit quota?
Yeah.
Because he's seeing the fallout happen and he's like, what do I do? So what does he do?
Well, first you have to have the mentality that a lower subscription, you know, a lower AR, ACV for the firm, for that company is not a disaster. You know, so, hey, you know, they're going to renew, but at 20% less.
Okay.
You know, that is so much better, 1,000% better than losing the customer. You know, and then you, you know, we offer 2 months free, a bit of a hiatus on the, you know, to effectively lower their price, but also, you know, change when they have to pay so that maybe they can put it in the 2023 budget or what have you. So we give extra months. Or we give features, you know, we give like the upsell.
And this is existing, existing customers.
Yeah, I'm not,
Okay,
yes,
good.
Existing customers. Yeah, this is existing
because customers. This sounds like new customer deals. Okay, it's interesting.
Yeah, no, it's, these are existing customer deals. Every renewal is like, you know, is an absolute dogfight. You know, you just got to go in the, you know, and be ready with a quiver of things that cost you something, but don't cost you the customer. You know, and so the other, I have one more along those lines, cutting the prices. Oh, well, yeah, just adding, you know, a lot of times I bet you're with your son and he's like, man, I've got this new product that they're going to love and we're going to increase the ACV by $1,000 a month when they attach to this new product, you know. Hey, how would you like this new product for free? You know, all of a sudden. That's the guy, you know, those are the things that you do.
So what you're saying is you start thinking you really, your goal becomes don't lose the customer. That's the goal. Yeah. And then you say, but look, Alan, when you throw in that new product that you expected that you were going to increase your annual recurring revenue and you give it away, what happens a year or two from now when you really want to charge for that? You're never going to be able to get that guy to pay that upgraded thing. It sounds like your answer is that's a problem that's in the future. And right now you just needed to hold on to the customer.
Yeah. Well, and of course you say, we'll give it to you free for a year.
Oh, I see.
So at least at least you have the optionality of potentially increasing.
Okay. Well, that's a smart way to do it. There you go.
Yeah.
Those are your marketing chops coming back, right?
There you go. There you go.
Is there the other thing that you mentioned earlier is the strength of a balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So how can you use the strength of your balance sheet as an as a startup in this type, this upcoming environment? How do you use the strength of your balance sheet to kind of help build your company, differentiate yourself?
First, let's assume that you don't have a strong balance sheet. Because most of us don't, you know. And the thing that can really help you out is letters from investors, which basically say we're fully supportive of the company, we anticipate future financings, and we're prepared to do so. You know, and have those ready. So when the company diligence comes down and they go, hey, man, why do you only have $5 million in the bank? You go, but look, our investors are incredibly supportive, you know, and we're going to be in good shape because they're going to, you know, they're bullish on the company. So that's one. The other thing is the balance sheet. If you have a balance sheet, man, you can sell well against other people so well. You know, we have an internet security
company. All of a sudden it becomes a feature.
Exactly. We have an internet security company. It's got 85 million, right, on the balance sheet. You know, I'm like, show that baby. It's not perfect, but, you know, make sure that they know that company X certainly doesn't have $85 million on the balance sheet, you know, so.
Well, what about you? I'm going to close with a couple of questions on the B2B business. So what challenges do you have? Yeah, you told me about the challenges that you had in the former environment, the environment we're exiting. You get into this new environment.
What
are the challenges for you as a VC as moving into a contraction?
Yeah.
You're doing two things. One is you got to find a couple more deals for Fund 8, and now you're raising money for Fund 9 in this environment. Kind of talk to those two things.
I mean, first of all, we have been a very conservative, consistent strategy. And all of a sudden, that is incredibly popular. So people aren't going to, you know, the institutions aren't going to completely abandon the asset class, but all of a sudden, wow, Nora Mosley's not so boring after all. So that's, we don't know, but that's why we have confidence in Reason. You know, and again, everybody seems to be raising $500 million funds and $700 million funds. We just want to be able to continue to do what we're doing, which is lead A rounds, which have gotten slightly larger. And that's why we're raising more money. On the portfolio company side, you know, honesty about the valuations, I think, is going to be the most important. You know, it's just really being able to hand over a paper that shows your current valuations on each of those companies and feel good that you're not overstating them. That you have, you know, a very strong basis for and conviction for why you're valuing them as they are. Because, the unrealized portion of venture capital holdings is enormous right now, you know, because people haven't sold stuff, but they're carrying it at incredibly high values. And that yields, understandably, a massive amount of skepticism in the limited partner world. So you need to be able to hit that head on and to explain why your returns are real.
Yeah, so that creates that credibility for future funds is what it's really all about. Yeah, so building a reputation. And like you said, you've been in business since 1983. That's a pretty long time there for a VC firm.
Yeah, seriously.
And you've been around 24 years with Noro.
I know.
Fantastic. Yeah. What do you see happening? But I think I'm certainly on the way out here. Okay, you know, as an angel investor, what do you see? What do you see for angel investing? You know, you've seen it change over the years, and like you said, we've had four new seed funds that started in the last 18 months or so.
Yeah,
in Atlanta, which we never dreamed would ever happen. We thought angels would sort of take that space.
Exactly.
You know, where do angels fit anymore? You know, it's really a question that I have.
Yeah. Well, I think this is going to be a great time for angel investors because I think the fundraising on the institution side, the seed funds are still a drop in the bucket relative to what the, you know, dollar amount of seed is actually going to work. So I think angels are going to continue to have a great place, and they're going to, portfolio companies or these companies are going to need substantially more cash, ironically, early on to get to the milestones where they can get into a real valuation. You know, all of a sudden, it's not going to be $3 million that's going to get you $100 million. You know what I mean? So I think there's going to be some capacity. And plus, I think it's the time to get rid of safe notes. I mean, it's time to take your power back. You know, this is the time to take your power back. This is the time to go back to a security that protects you, that doesn't, you know, that you don't take all the risk and not get all the reward.
That it will also get rid of convertible notes?
I think it will change the convertible note price. I think the convertible notes will be automatic, and I think the conversion prices, instead of being $15 million, might be six. You know what I mean? I can see the some downward pressure, but you can get rid of convertible notes.
Because I always looked at convertible notes, as not much greater than not much greater value than safe notes.
That's when you're absolutely true.
Stage like that. I mean, what power do I have? What am I going to wind up with? The product?
That's really a good point, Charlie. Maybe it is time to get rid of convertible notes.
Yeah. I would just do priced rounds. You want to get
exactly.
in? You're in. Okay. This is the deal.
Do a priced round. I'm sorry you're at $6 million, that's what you're worth, right? Don't make me hold the bag while you try to get more.
Yep. That's exactly what it is. And I think that we have some people, and I'm in one of these, one deal that where I did put some follow on money into a convertible note at a too high a valuation. And so I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, great. I got a convertible note. What am I supposed to do with it?
I'll tell you one interesting twist on the convertible note I've seen, which is, you have X months to raise the round. And if you don't raise the round, the convertible note goes to the last money priced at.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
All right. So what advice, the last thing, and we'll close. Give me the advice. What advice you give to these Series A seeking entrepreneurs as to what they should be doing to prepare their business to make it attractive for a guy like you?
Well, first, I'm going to say, don't be too discouraged. There's still a lot of good fundamentals in the market that I think will help us get through this recession and make it not as painful as some people were saying. So hang in there, I guess, could be one. But yeah, I think it's time for you to look for partners and stop looking for valuation.
What does that say? Look for partners.
Look for partners and not for valuations.
Okay.
Yeah. Look for the Charlies who are going to help, who may not be the most, who might not be willing to pay $50 million.
Got it.
It's time, it's time for you to find partners.
But I think a lot of those guys that are looking for Series A money, in a lot of cases, I think that they're going to find themselves in an overvalued situation.
Yeah.
Which is really dangerous. That case, I guess the thing is to hunker down and get yourself to positive cash flow or to the smallest burn you possibly can as quickly as you can. Staying alive becomes more important than maybe that next round, in fact.
Absolutely. You got to give yourself optionality.
All right. Well, I'm going to close this out. And Alan, I would appreciate if you hold on there for just a little bit. Okay. After I stop recording and I just want to say a few things to you. Appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Charlie.
Well, thank you, Alan. And thanks everybody for joining me and Alan. This has been a great conversation. I hope it's helpful for you as you're planning your startup funding and also getting into your next stage, maybe towards your Series A. We'll get through this. Stay positive. I love that advice. Thanks.